They both grew up in Maryland. They both grew up in the early music world. And they both grew up kind of pushing the boundaries of early music. Yet they've never had a chance to make music together. They are Carolyn Surik, a viola da gambist and founding member of Ensemble Galilei, and Ron McFarlane, a founding member of the Baltimore Consort, who became infatuated with the lute in the 1970s. During the global pandemic, they finally had the time to make music together, and they decided, why not make a recording? So they did. It's called Fermi's Paradox, and that's what you're going to be hearing about this week on New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julia Mocker. I'm going to start off by just having you introduce yourself to people who may not know you. And I'd like to start with Carolyn. Let's start off by having you tell us a little bit about you as a founder of Ensemble Galilei back in 1990. You made 15 recordings with them, and you've been involved with so many other groups, and I know collaborations are very important to you. So tell me a little bit more about yourself, Carolyn.
Well, yes, I founded Ensemble Galilei in 1990, and we've had a wonderful, wonderful career of touring and collaborating with institutions to create multidisciplinary shows. We worked with the Hubble Space Telescope Institute, and we worked with National Geographic, and we worked with the Metropolitan Museum of Art to create works that were spoken word and music and photographs. And that's just been, it has been a very, very rewarding part of our work, as well as we have worked on Trio Galilei has done a significant amount of work at Walter Reed, working with wounded warriors in Washington, D.C. And the way that Ron and I got together was because we were going to do a house concert and then COVID happened. And so this was another collaboration, a really different kind of collaboration for me, and incredibly exciting. And one of the things that really changed my experience of living through COVID, actually, was having and developing a new and intensely rewarding musical relationship.
You play viola da gamba. Tell me a little bit about this instrument and how it's either different or similar than what we might call a cello today.
Yes, well, both are from families of instruments. The viola da gamba, the viola of the leg, comes in all different sizes, as does the violin family of the violas of the arm, viola da braccia. Sometime in the middle of the 15th century, each of these families of instruments came up. The viola and violin family has four strings, and they're bowed overhand, and they're tuned in fifths. And the viola da gamba family are all held vertically. You hold them all between your legs, even the tiniest one, which is a little challenging unless you're a very, very short person. Anyway, they have five, six, or seven strings, and they are tuned in fourths with a third in the middle, and it has a different bow grip. The gamba family was super popular in England and in France, and the violin family was super popular in Germany and Italy. And the gambas went out of style when big bands came into style. When Mozart and Haydn started writing for orchestras, some of the qualities that are most expressive in the gamba family are the qualities least needed in an orchestra. For instance, one of the things that can happen when you're playing gamba that you want to have happen is you have a whole series of overtones that are sort of ringing inside the instrument. Which, when you're in a small ensemble, is just heaven. But if you're trying to get da-da-da-da, you really want focused, loud sound, and you don't want a whole series of overtones happening. That was part of the demise of the gamba. But another part of it was that you wanted loud. And you can go from having four gut strings on a cello to four metal strings, which are louder, and it's fine. But if you take seven gut strings and you replace them with seven metal strings on a gamba, the neck will break off. It's not good. So there's like no way to continue playing. So the gambas went out of style, except for in a small town in Wales, where playing the viola da gamba is an unbroken tradition. Like, that's the only place on the planet where they never stopped.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, how did it become your instrument then?
Oh, it was the 70s. I was in a group that did a lot of vocal music from the Renaissance and a cappella arrangements of jazz standards. And I thought that I wanted to play the bowed stringed instrument that was historically appropriate for early music. And lucky for me, the Viola da Gamba Society of America was founded 12 miles from my home. So the widow of the person who founded the society had 20 instruments hanging around. And someone said, call Eloise. She'll loan you one. And so I was 16 and I called Eloise Glenn and I went down to her house and there were instruments everywhere. And she fixed a lovely lunch, which I shared with Dr. Oliver Wendell Margrave, who was a composer and teacher in DC. And she said, here's your instrument. Here's your teacher. Bring it back when you have one of your own. And so it was just dreamy. I picked it up and it was the one for me. I mean, there was just like no question.
Are you still playing that instrument?
Oh, no.
Oh, okay. So you took it back when you got your own.
I did. It wasn't long, actually. I think within a year, I bought my own instrument and I paid for it myself. And it was really, really important. Yeah.
Ron, back in the 70s, you picked up the lute. What made you do that?
Well, I had been a guitarist since my early teens and had gone through my rock and roll phase and my classical guitar phase, my folk guitar phase. And I found that of the classical guitar music that I was playing, I loved the Renaissance and Baroque music the most. And almost all of that music had originally been lute music that was then arranged for the classical guitar. So as my guitar repertory filled up more and more with Renaissance and Baroque music, I started to wonder what these tunes would feel like, what they would sound like if they were played on the instrument that they were originally written for. And more I just became smitten with the idea of the lute. And I read about it and dreamed about it. And finally, I went to Washington, D.C., right around DuPont Circle, where there was a guitar and lute shop. And there I held a lute on my lap for the first time. And even though I had read so much about it, I knew a lot about it, I'd never actually physically held one in my hands. And it was so unbelievably awkward and ungainly as I tried to hold it in my lap and it was keep slipping around. The person behind the counter just had to say, "You sure you know what you're doing?" And And in a way, I knew what I was doing. My body didn't have a clue what it was doing. So I persevered. I did eventually get a lute. And gradually, oh, so gradually, it began to feel more and more comfortable. And I became accustomed to that feeling, to that string tension and string length, the double courses of a lute and, the very different feeling of a lute from the guitar, until eventually it became almost like an extension of my body. It felt natural, but it felt anything but natural when I first held it, the instrument. And that's probably true of anyone for any instrument the first time you hold an instrument. But this was quite a shock to me because I already played the guitar pretty well by that time, and I knew about the lute, and yet my body knew nothing.
Because collaboration is so important to both of you, the global pandemic added a new challenge, and it also helped you discover something unique between the two of you. Can you talk about how your Saturday morning sessions developed, which led to this recording?
Well, I mean, It's almost impossible to imagine that we had never performed together before. We both grew up in Maryland. We both grew up in the early music world. We also both grew up sort of pushing the boundaries of early music. And so the fact that we had never like actually spent much time in each other's presence was hysterical. In fact, Ron reminded me that when I was doing my master's in like 1990, I interviewed him for my master's thesis. I was like, oh yeah, we did meet back in 1990. But so we started rehearsing on Saturday mornings for a concert that never happened because of the pandemic. But the time was so beautiful that we were like, well, let's just keep like developing repertoire and bringing new things and finding new music. And so we did that for months. And finally I said, well, Ron, you know, we could record a new CD. And he's like, I can't possibly. We don't have enough time. I'm like, yeah, actually, there's nothing else in the world happening. And so that was just this incredibly fascinating process. I mean, when people actually see us perform now, they're like, you guys have been playing together forever, right? And we're like, yeah, 18 months.
So this is the first time you've recorded together, too. Is that right?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
That is really amazing. I had that down as a question. I'm like, oh, surely they've, at some point in all of their ensembles, they've encountered one another. So that's really exciting. It's been really exciting to talk to artists to find out what opportunities they have discovered during the last year and a half, things that they probably would never have explored had they not been put in this new situation. So that's pretty exciting to hear. Why is the title of this recording, Fermi's Paradox, so appropriate in representing the recording itself and the music it reflects?
Well, I should just back up for those who don't know about Fermi's Paradox. It refers to Enrico Fermi, who was an Italian physicist who flourished in the middle of the 20th century. And his paradox was, well, he was just remarking at how strange it was that there's an overwhelming scientific probability that there's intelligent life on other planets, other galaxies, and yet there's absolutely no scientific evidence of their existence. So where is everyone? So for us, I think the idea of is anybody out there and where is everyone made this an especially poignant idea at a time when we had no concerts, in a world where a musician might travel and tour to make a living. There's absolutely nothing one can do except just play music at home. And in the case of Carolyn and me, we live not far away, so we continued rehearsing and continued to make music together all the way through this. So I think it's just a testament to the importance of connection and community and just making contact with people, not just ourselves, but also reaching out to the world as a whole at a time when we were all shut down and locked down.
The two of you didn't have a lot of shared music between you, so that meant that you had to spend a lot of time and energy creating new pieces, discovering new pieces, coming up with new arrangements. What was most challenging and or rewarding about that?
Well, there are two parts of that, one of which is that that we didn't have shared repertoire, but the other is that we didn't want to record things we'd recorded before. And when you've recorded as many CDs collectively as the two of us have recorded, I mean, when you're recording CDs, generally speaking, at a certain point, you're going to pick your favorite pieces. And so, and after, you know, 30 years, you've picked a lot of favorite pieces and then you've already played them on a recording. So we had to find a whole new set of pieces that we loved that were our favorite pieces that we had never recorded before. It was fascinating. It's like, no, we can't do that one. I recorded it. No, can't do that one. He recorded it.
I'm surprised you can remember all the ones you've recorded. Carolyn, you've said that the music on this recording flowed organically. Can you talk a little bit about how that happened?
The process of making music and the process of putting this project together was really, really fascinating because we were in a position to not only pick and choose what we wanted to do, because we weren't making a thematic recording. But then we also had the opportunity to try out any arrangement that we could possibly imagine. So that was like this incredible gift. And we had no time constraints. You know, sometimes you're putting together concerts or recordings in days. You know, you really are trying to form something complete in a very limited period of time. In this particular instance, we had all of the time in the world. And so we could take a melody. And we could create harmonies. We could create counter melodies. We could try them out, and we could try plucking. I could try bowing and plucking, and then we could trade parts. So it was this really remarkable and rewarding process.
I think we wanted to create as much variety as possible. And I think we wanted to do things that we found fun ourselves. We wanted to make the kind of recording that we would enjoy listening to. That's certainly the case for me. And I've got to say, a lot of recordings that I've done in the past had a rather narrow focus. I would play a recording of all the music of John Dowland, all the lute music of Vivaldi, or of Italian music of the early 16th century. But this is an album that really encompasses everything that I do, I think everything that we do, in that it has Renaissance music, it has Baroque music, it has traditional Celtic music, it has traditional Swedish tune, a couple of Swedish tunes. It has original music that we've written. It even has an Allman Brothers tune that I used to love listening to in college back around the early 1970s. So I think more than any recording that we've made, or that I have made in the past, it represents all the different musical loves that I have, all the different kinds of things that I love to play, but not narrowly focused, rather just the whole bouquet of musical styles, musical languages blended together into a recording. And it's amazing how it does blend together. It doesn't, you know, having an Allman Brothers tune and having, say, Ave Maria with Bach and Gounod, they don't clash with one another somehow. It actually worked.
We're putting sets together of music that you would never think of putting together. You know, it was really like having the world's most beautiful palette of colors in your hands and being able to choose at any given moment what color you wanted to have next.
It's interesting to me because just putting it on and listening from start to finish, there's things that I recognize. I think the average listener will recognize, even if we don't know the title, right? It's like, oh, I think I know that. And then there are things that I don't recognize, yet they sound familiar. So you did a really beautiful job in finding things that really fit together. And I'm curious also about the mood. Were you trying to create any kind of atmosphere with this music?
I don't think that you can take music out of the context of life. I mean, I think that as we were making this recording, we were incredibly aware of what was going on in the world around us. And we were putting this music together in what is arguably one of the scariest and most challenging times in recent history. And I think that in its own way, not that we intended to do that, but that the music really speaks to finding beauty in a hard place. I'm pretty sure that if we were going to have a first recording at a different time, that the repertoire would have been really different than it was to be putting music together when we were finding out about what COVID was, when the world was locking down, when people stopped leaving their homes. I think that context is everything.
What musical discoveries did each of you uncover as you were putting this recording together?
I would say with the title piece, Fermi's Paradox. That's a piece that I wrote. Originally, I tried to write it as a solo lute piece, but it always felt a little awkward. It always felt like it didn't quite fit. The discovery was that when I shared the piece with Carolyn and gave certain melodies to Viola da Gamba, put a deep low A drone under a couple of spots, and then we'd trade back and forth. Carolyn would pluck sometimes, bow other times. The piece came alive in a way that it never would, never could when I was trying to play it as a solo. The lute by itself just didn't have the breadth that was encompassed in the music, that was inherent in the music as it was written. So that was really a discovery. Much as I might try to write a solo, oftentimes it works much better if you share the music.
How about for you, Carolyn?
I think that for me, it was incredibly fascinating to be working with one other person. Ensemble Galilee usually has five or six musicians in it. These days, or for the last 10 or 15 years, there are bagpipes and fiddles. And my job is to play the gamba as loud as anyone has ever played the gamba. Because I am holding up the bottom of an ensemble that's got some people who can really bring it when it comes to volume. And so when playing with Ron, it was like this whole new world, not only of sort of dynamic range and finding out where the edges of quiet were and where being present and being quiet met. But then there's this other thing that happened, which is that because there were only two of us in the room, you can be instantly responsive. Like any place that Ron decided to go or any place that I decided to go, in terms of phrasing and in terms of dynamics and in terms of articulation, anything that you wanted to do musically, the person is right there with you. I mean, because they can really hear you and because it's just the two of you there. So it's like it's being instantly responsive to musical ideas in a way that I have to say was pretty new to me. I mean, I've accompanied a lot of people. I've been in ensembles with numerous peoples, but having this sort of very, very intimate musical relationship was just a revelation. Dowland's Adieu for Master Cromwell has a level of stillness that's completely unparalleled in my musical experience. I mean, it's just remarkable how the two instruments are there, present with each other, but actually acting as one. And then in the Telemann Sonata, instead of having just the normal kinds of titles, it's cantabile and it's arioso and it's recitative. So it's very emotional and it's very Italian and it's very operatic. And so being able to play that with Ron, where we could, you know, you're in this recitative, you're like as angry and masculine as you can be. And then there's this beautiful moment where the woman is saying, but wait. Thank you. that's just so much fun to do together.
John Barleycorn is an Irish tune that you hadn't heard before, Carolyn. Why did it fit so well with She Moved Through the Fair?
I am such a fan of traditional Irish music. And I think that when you have the opportunity to put tunes together like that, that really, really have a feel that's groovy, it was amazing. When Ron brought those two together, I was like, oh my gosh, this is awesome. Totally awesome.
I've been a rabid fan of traditional Celtic music since about 1980, or actually in the 70s. And I've loved all the popular Irish bands and individual players. And some of that music, actually some Scottish music, actually is written for lute. Back in the 17th century, there are about 600 or so pieces for lute from Scottish manuscripts. But there's no Irish music. So I think that was a big oversight, and I'm trying to correct that now as much as possible. But these are just tunes that I knew and that I loved from hearing traditional versions of them. And we're just trying to reimagine them on these instruments that we're playing.
You both love the Irish harper Turlough O'Carolan. Yet neither of you had ever recorded the piece that you ended up putting on this recording. Tell me what this piece is and what's so special about it.
We have both recorded a lot of O'Carolan, and there are some gems, and there are some things that everybody records. And when I came across this piece, it was so unusual. And I usually think that in the book that has all of the tunes that O'Carolan wrote that were collected, you can sort of track which ones were the early ones and which ones were the late ones by the sound of them. Clearly, as he sort of got further along, Corelli went to Dublin. You've got some stuff that sounds very Baroque that O'Carolan did. And then you get to some of the earlier pieces, and they're just like, they're almost stream of consciousness music. And they're very modal, and sometimes they're a little austere in a way that I find very, very compelling. And when I first started playing this tune, I was really struck by how it worked at two different tempos. That there's the sort of really heartachy, keening version of it. And then there's another version of it that to me is like, it's like ice skating. It's like when you're out on wild ice, when you're out on a lake or a pond in the winter, not in a rink, you know, just like there are a few other people out there and you're just skating, and the air is freezing cold, but the stars are out and there's a moon and you're just skating, and it's so smooth and so beautiful. And that's the way I felt about this O'Carolan piece, was that when there was a way that we would play it together, and it was like so much like being on ice skates in the winter. And so, I'm sure that in terms of Irish traditional playing, people don't usually think of this piece in ice skating, but for me, that was exactly what it felt like, and I loved it so much.
It seems that you asked yourself as you were putting this recording together, if this, then why not that? I'm curious if that train of thought took you in any surprising directions.
Well, I think there are a few surprises. One of them was Blackwaterside. That's a traditional tune that I first became aware of on a Led Zeppelin album. The first Led Zeppelin album has an acoustic guitar piece on it called Black Mountainside. And listened to it, I guess I was 16 or so at the time, and thought it was the coolest thing. I just assumed that Jimmy Page, the guitarist in Led Zeppelin, had written it. But years and years and years later, I found that it was a traditional tune, goes back hundreds of years. Blackwaterside, it has verses, it has words. And I became enamored of a Burt Jansch version of it which is actually the version that the Led Zeppelin version draws from. So went back to that source and listened to his version and came up with my own, basically using his materials, but then building on that. And, you know, that's the way traditional music works anyway.
Ron, you included two tributes to friends on this recording. Could you tell us about those tributes, who they're for, who you're honoring?
Well, Trinity Grove is a sort of retreat of one of my best friends in the world. We've known each other since we were 17 and played in rock bands together and went to college together and stayed in touch through all the years. So his name is Dave Selby, and it's a place that he has in Maryland. And I think after years and years, Dave had dreamed of a place in the country. And it's really is his dream house. He bought this this tract of land that had a shack on it, but eventually razed that and built the home of his dreams. And it has three very noble tall trees. That's the Trinity in the backyard. And it's just a beautiful space and a realization of one of my best friend's dreams. The other one is Daniel Chacon, which I wrote for Daniel Shaskis, who's a very fine lutenist who does some urology on the side. When he's not playing the lute, he's transplanting kidneys at the Cleveland Clinic. But I wrote this for him. He wanted a piece that was kind of like a Chacon or a Passacaglia. And we still haven't agreed to this day whether it's a Chacon or a Passacaglia. I insist that it's a Chacon. He insists that it's a Passacaglia. And if you knew us, you would know that neither of us is going to give an inch in that. And still, we're great friends. Daniel recorded this a few years ago, I think in 2013. So he debuted it, but I wanted to have my say on the piece also. So it's very much for him, for Danny.
Carolyn, there is a medley on this recording that includes a piece you wrote called The Last Day, and it's a piece that reflects the weight of deep loss. Can you talk more about that, please?
Actually, I wrote a book called The Last Day. In our family, we had many losses between 2012 and 2018. And we were there for them. Death was present in our lives in a very, very close way. And when we were putting this project together, I felt like there was something that I wanted to say about that. And I think of the passing of our beloveds as something that it's a great gift to us. For anyone who's had the opportunity to be with someone as they're coming to the end of their lives, you realize that the gift of your presence is that you are receiving the gift. The person who's passing into the next world, everybody thinks you're so noble for being with them, but really the gift that they give you is the greatest gift that a human can have, and it comes at such a high cost. Those are moments of incredible beauty and sorrow, and I think that I've been very lucky to have been able to go to those places with the people I love. And so that's what that piece is about.
Now that we're moving into kind of this new period, sort of, it's not post-pandemic, but we're hopefully past the worst. I'm curious, how have your perspectives maybe changed about your place in the world, either as musicians or in general?
We're a duo. We didn't used to be. We are now seriously a duo. So my perspective has very, very much changed because now I have a new partner in music.
Absolutely. For me too. I think we probably never would have played much together if this hadn't happened. I think we were going to play a house concert together. But I think this experience just sort of bonded us as musicians and really makes us think forward to future projects, future touring that we would like to do together, because it's a very fruitful musical relationship.
A new recording featuring Carolyn Surik and Ron McFarlane, the first recording they've been able to make together. It's called Fermi's Paradox. Since you're clearly a music fan, let me tell you about another podcast you might enjoy. It's The Piano Puzzler. Each week, host Fred Child invites composer Bruce Adolph into the studio to play one of his brilliant mind games. Bruce takes a familiar tune and disguises it in the style of a classical composer. Then a contestant calls in to try to solve the riddle. It's a lot of fun. If you're up for the challenge, subscribe to The Piano Puzzler wherever you get your podcast. This podcast is New Classical Tracks from American Public Media, and if you're enjoying it, the best thing you can do for the show is to tell somebody else about it and help spread the word and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. Thanks to our producer, Valerie Kaler. I'm Julie Amacher.